Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Now, the first interview you're going to hear today, this guest was kind enough to provide some additional research materials, so some of the questions are based on that. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Michaela Poling from the Freeman Sheldon Research Group. So, tell me a little bit about the latest happenings with the research group.
Well, we have shifted focus, and initially we were exclusively focused on trying to get started with human participant research, and then branched out to provide support services and connecting people with one another so that they would have better peer-to-peer support. However, peer-to-peer support has been almost entirely supplanted by direct connecting of individuals using social media. So really, the use of disease support groups for helping individuals to connect with one another is really a relic of the past. Additionally, we have had some very considerable resistance to individuals being interested in participating in research because they hear the R word. Many of them have had poor experiences with other researchers in the past who were interested more in basic science, which is understanding the essential biology of life as far as it relates to this syndrome. However, what we were interested in is creating studies that in and of themselves would help patients to at least understand more about what was going on with them and what options might be available to them for treatment or to gain better understanding as to what maybe they needed to consider for the future. That doesn't mean that we cannot make new strides in understanding what is going on with the syndrome, which is Freeman, F-R-E-E-M-A-N, Sheldon, S-H-E-L-D-O-N, syndrome. And we have done this. We have extrapolated a lot of data from the existing literature. We have pulled together our considerable clinical experience helping patients. And we've come together with a lot of, I think, very helpful findings that still will be very impactful to patients' lives, to improve their quality of life, to give better understanding to doctors as far as what is this syndrome really and what isn't it. And that seems to be the biggest problem that we have and the greatest barrier to patient care. It's not a lack of awareness about the syndrome. It's a lack of awareness of what the syndrome is. Many doctors like to consider that it's a syndrome based just on genetics or just on problems with the hands or the feet, when in reality, it is a problem primarily of the face and of the muscles that frequently, but not always, involves problems with the hands and the feet. So we have put together a series of papers to explain the underlying basis of the syndrome. We have renamed the syndrome to be more consistent with that greater understanding of the basis biologically and functionally of the syndrome. The new name is Freeman, Freeman, hyphen, Burian, Burian, syndrome. And this is something that we hope, with increased understanding, that this is a craniofacial syndrome, primarily that is centered in problems with the muscles, that can frequently also manifest as problems in other areas such as the hands, the feet, the spine.
So you mentioned that surgery is an option for a lot of cases of this. Are there any other treatments you're aware of, or is it just the surgery?
Physical therapy and surgery, in that order, are the most critical elements to care for patients with Freeman-Burian syndrome.
Okay. So I'm also wondering, you mentioned about stigmas people face and challenges in the community and in school. How do people go about clearing up the myths and getting beyond those stigmas?
Most people are able to excel academically. And when other individuals see, hey, Sally, she really knows what she's doing, or Joe, he's awesome on a computer, then you start to break down those stigmas. But really, there is ample research across many craniofacial differences that go to support the idea that that's always going to be there. And so it's incumbent on the doctor, the family, and those who love the patient to really keep reminding them, you're not what other people think you are. You're awesome. And to encourage that person to continue to work hard, because through hard work and by understanding and accepting that the rest of the world is never going to immediately accept them, through they can overcome anything, because through extreme hard work and excelling beyond what their peers who have normal facial appearances, what they accomplish, then they will be able to find happiness and fulfillment, because the quality of what they're doing is what will gain the recognition.
So, do you know how many people statistically are affected by the condition?
It is extremely small, the numbers who are affected worldwide. And because it is so small, there are no hard numbers that I can quote you. It has been reported, although I believe probably erroneously, that the statistical frequency is 1 in a million. However, I also have seen quoted as the number being around 200 in the world that are affected.
So, if you could send any message to the community about why it is those with this condition should just be treated with respect and equality, what would you say?
People with the syndrome may look different, but they are in every other way a normal, capable individual who's simply wearing a mask. And it's critical to look beyond the mask and see the capability of the individual, and not to either overly exaggerate positively or negatively the traits or characteristics of that individual, but take them on their ability. And that is the most important thing for individuals who have the condition. Focus on your ability and develop that, not on what you look like or how you may feel about yourself. Focus on developing your ability, and the rest will work itself out.
Thank you very much. This next segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Jerry Nelson, who will be telling us a little bit about the sport of blind golf. So tell me a little bit about the sport of blind golf.
Well, Cam, blind golfers play with the aid of a sighted guide, and all the rules are the same, with the exception of being able to ground a club in a hazard, a sand bunker, things like that. But we have three various sight categories. You have to be legally blind to play in tournaments, but we won't turn anyone away. And you just get a guide. People will use their guides differently. Myself, for example, I'm totally blind. So I rely on my guide for a total setup. We talk about club selection, yardage. He gets out of the way, or at least he's supposed to. I hit the ball and go do it all over again. Some people with a little better vision than mine will rely on their guide to follow the ball, you know, after they tee it up themselves, things like that. But we play at a recreational level. We play at a competitive level. We play locally, nationally, and internationally. It's a sport that we certainly want to grow here in Canada and around the world, but our motto, Cam, is you can still play, and we want people to know that. Young people, seniors who have maybe played golf and lost their vision and thought they couldn't play anymore, well, we're here to tell you that, yes, you can. You can still play.
So how did you get involved with the sport?
Actually, I lost my eyesight in 1988, Cam, and there was a fella who was involved with blind golf here in Saskatoon, and he was a member of the Saskatoon Lions Club. And he had just parted ways with a blind golfer that he had been working with, and he was looking for somebody else to get involved. And I was at a blind sports symposium, swung the golf club a little bit, and the two fellas that were running the blind golf booth, they got word back to my coach that, hey, there's a new young kid who's got a pretty good-looking golf swing. Maybe you should get a hold of him, and my coach did. We went out and hit a bucket of balls using his wife's clubs at the driving range, and I hit some balls that summer, but I actually waited another season to get into it. But once I did, Cam, I jumped in with both feet, and no pun intended, but I've never looked back. I've been playing blind golf for 30 years now and just absolutely love it.
Are there any challenges in the sport itself?
The only challenge is, Cam, really, just to be able to find the funding to put on some of these tournaments that we do. But in terms of the actual game itself, it's almost just the opposite, Cam. It's the best example of peer support that you're ever going to find. We get 20, 30, 40, 50 people out to a tournament. Nobody is sitting around whining or complaining or talking about how much they can't see. Everybody's talking about that putt that they missed or they made, or that 300-yard drive that actually only went 200, but they're talking it up after the round. So like I said, the only difficulty that we have, and our tournament hosts do a great job of fundraising locally within the communities for us to be able to host these tournaments, but that would be the only difficulty, really, that I see.
So, you mentioned you've been playing for over 3 decades, and in that time, I'd imagine you've seen a lot of successes. What's been the greatest?
Well, it's funny that you asked that, Cam, because we just came back from a 10 days, 3-tournament adventure into BC, and I've won some tournaments. I've won our own Canadian Open 4 times. I was third in the world, but one of the biggest victories, in terms of us trying to grow the game here in Canada and around the world, at our Canadian Open in Cranbrook, British Columbia, at a course called St. Eugene Mission, we had a situation where they awarded me second place in the B1 division, which is totally blind, and there was a scoring error, and a new upcoming golfer from Mexico had actually finished 3 shots ahead of me, and was absolutely heartbroken that he thought maybe he wasn't eligible to win or they give the local guys the prizes. That is not, in fact, correct. So what we did, my guide Chris and I, we assembled everybody together and we presented the Mexican guys with the award for second place in our B1 division. And you've got to understand the English, these guys barely spoke English, but after we gave them their medals, the silence was deafening, and Ricardo was the golfer's name, and he said, "Jerry," and it was silent, and then he said, "I love you." And there wasn't a dry eye in the house. I still get a little bit emotional talking about it. But, to us out there that have been there a while, it's all about growing the game. It's about bringing out new golfers. So, if I never win another tournament, Cam, that's been the highlight of my career. And we have other examples of things happening like that. But, we want to make sure that golfers from around the world remember Canada when they come, and we want to make sure that they have a good time. And to have a fella tell me that was just really, up to now, the highlight of my blind golf career.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yeah, no problem.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages. So stay tuned.
The summer holidays are here, and Design Systems Canada reminds motorists that with our children's newfound freedom comes added responsibility for all of us who drive. More than any other time of year, we need to be extra cautious near playgrounds, crosswalks, and in residential areas. Please slow down whenever you see children and help make this summer a safe one. A message from Design Systems Canada, 3585 Rhodes Drive, Windsor. An area business that cares about the community they serve. Visit dsidsc.ca.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Michaela Poling and Jerry Nelson. In this segment of our show, we're going to hear from Paula Murphy from the Pegasus Project. So tell me a little bit about Pegasus.
So Pegasus is located in Toronto, and it was started, it's actually our 25th anniversary this year. It was started by a group of people who were a little concerned about their children who were about to graduate from high school. So when children with developmental disabilities are in school, they're allowed to stay till they're 21. But after that, there is quite lengthy wait lists for services. So Marie Parada, who has a son with a developmental disability, and 4 other people, approached the a local community center, and inquired about being able to provide programming in there. And so that's how it began, with a founding board of five and some children, and then it grew from there. So currently, 25 years later, there's four different program locations in community centers within the east, kind of upper beach and east end of Toronto. And we also operate a social enterprise thrift store that helps fund the organization.
So can you give me an overview of some of the programs aside from the social enterprise you mentioned?
Mm-hmm.
Just what all is offered to the clients?
We try to individualize the supports as much as possible, so it's based on what they want, what their goals, what their dreams, what their needs and wants are. But some of the overall offerings are things like drama, music. We do yoga, massage therapy. We partner with massage students. They do cooking, different life skills. Some people are supported to volunteer. Some are supported to work in locations in Toronto. Like I said, it's kind of individualized. One of the core values of Pegasus is to be embedded in the community and be part of the community. And so a lot of what we do is in the community.
So are there any challenges in these efforts?
Always challenges. Trying to balance participant needs with staffing resources. Of course, being a not-for-profit and relying on not only government funding but donations and fees, it's always challenging to provide enough support for people. We try to have a higher staff ratio than some other programs just so we can provide some individualized support. But again, that can be challenging when some of the needs of people increase over the years, and perhaps our funding hasn't increased, so we haven't been able to add additional staff. So that's the biggest challenge.
So to look at the converse side of things, in your time with Pegasus, what's been the greatest success story you've witnessed?
Well, I've only been here 3 years. Marie Parada retired, and then I was the lucky one who was her successor. So in my 3 years, I think a big, big, big thing that has happened is we hired someone who is a creative genius, and she created a film festival. So it's called PIFF, P-I-F-F, Pegasus Inspirational Film Festival. And each program that we have, the first year, partnered with a film student. They created a short film, and then we had a big gala with red carpet, and we... it was on the big screen in a cinema downtown. And it was so well received that we expanded it last year. So last year was our second year, and we opened it up to other organizations. So we had 8, I believe, films total. And again, we had a big gala. We had red carpet interviews. We had pictures. We had, the whole 9 yards. And so the people we support and people in other organizations were able to see themselves on the big screen and were celebrated for their talents and their accomplishments. And the big thing about the films are they are the subject matter is decided, the genre is decided, it's, created by, acted by, and sometimes filmed by the people we support. They are part of the entire decision-making. And so it really is an inclusive film experience for them. If someone is not comfortable being in front of the camera, then they are encouraged to, they could do some filming with support, or they could create perhaps costumes or props or whatever the case may be. But everybody's supported to be as involved as they are comfortable with and as they want to. We have some who are big hams and want to be, in front of the camera, and then other people say, no, I'd rather just be behind the scenes. So it's a really incredible event to be at, because you just see people being celebrated. People who usually aren't celebrated are incredibly celebrated at this event. And, you know, we use the word inspirational not in the typical way that we don't like for people. We want to inspire, you know, the general community and people in the community to be inspired by people's talents and people's skills. We want people to see beyond the label, and that has certainly happened with our film festival.
So I'm curious, can you tell me a little bit about the films themselves? What sorts of things were created?
So all kinds. We had stop animation, we had documentary, we had a black and white kind of comedy one. They're all very different. All of them are very different, and it really depends on the group and what they want to do. We've had music videos, we've had, try to educational ones. It's really incredible. And there's, you know, if you go to the website PIF Toronto, you can, I think, see little clips of them and get an idea.
So, are there any projects on the horizon for Pegasus at the moment?
We're planning our third annual film festival that will happen in October. Because it is our 25th year, we've already had one celebration at our annual picnic. We're planning some kind of fundraising event in the fall, which is still to be determined. We had a fashion show this year with our participants as the models, and we hope to do that every year. And then we're also looking for space, for new space to expand our program. That's a real big priority. We have a strategic plan, a 5-year, and one of our biggest priorities is finding space that we can call our own.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but
oh,
if you can
welcome.
Stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. So, I think Michaela had it exactly right when she said disability is kind of a mask, in so much as, yeah, it's a surface thing. It's one factor of a person's great tapestry. The way a person looks or moves or sees or hears or communicates, it is not the sole definition of who and what they are. People are learning more and more that you can't have a simple definition of a person's identity in any way. That's very true. You can't just say this person is that and just leave it at that. The complexities of a person are not only more than just what meets the eye. They're ever-changing. A person might start off being bitter and hopeless with an acquired disability. And a lot of people do feel that way. However, their whole perspective can change the instant they realize they are alive. They are a capable, thinking, potentialed human being. And honestly, what might have been just a surface thing, oh, my condition's a curse, might go to a place of, it's a set of factors. It's something I can work with. It's something I can seek support with. It's something that might even lead me to an opportunity in life that I didn't know existed. And honestly, a mask is but a surface. The way a person looks ain't very much about them at all. It may tell you a story of where they came from. And in the case of disability, it may tell the story of an injury or an accident or a difference in genetic factors. But it's not the whole story by itself. It may give you a clue as to a person's background. But look beyond the surface. Follow the trail of who a person is before you decide whether you want them around. Get to know them. Let them explore their own potential. Maybe even stand beside them. Be a voice of encouragement. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.